This is Forces Radio.
This is BFBS.
Never in the field of human conflict.
The Forces Network.
So much hope.
Celebrating.
By so many.
RAF 100.
100. To show you.
RAF 100. Wings over Cyprus.
The year is 1968. Sitcom Dad's Army first aired on TV. The Cray twins were arrested in dawn raids across London. The average price of a new car was £1,000, and this was in the top 10. ...1968 also saw the Royal Air Force mark the 50th anniversary of its formation. To celebrate the occasion, our predecessors created radio documentaries following six of the squadrons that were based at RAF Akrotiri.
Wings over Cyprus. We present the history of No. 70 Squadron, Royal Air Force, Akrotiri.
Of the six squadrons featured in Wings Over Cyprus, three are still operational today. Now, in 2018, we are finding out where those squadrons are on the centenary of the Royal Air Force and how that compares to their early beginnings documented in our archives.
Standing here in the squadron history room, surrounded by photographs of an assortment of aircraft, faded letters, combat reports, it's obvious that 70 have had a long and checkered career. Roy, you are the squadron historian. Can you tell us how it all began?
It started at Farnborough on 22nd of April 1916, and in something of an unusual manner. At first, just three aircraft and one man, who was awaiting in the engine repair park.
I was detailed to take over an empty hangar at Jersey Brow and await further instructions. The first thing to happen was that two massive crates arrived from the Sopwith Company, and these contained the fuselage and wings of the first 1.5 strutter. This aircraft was duly rigged together with another two, which came a couple of days later. I was told to call myself the Sopwith Squadron, and for some days just me, the hangar, and the three aircraft were the squadron.
The build-up of the squadron then continued rapidly, and ultimately comprised three flights. The war in France had reached a critical stage, and barely had the last flight formed before they were drafted to France to support the Battle of the Somme. Their task was mainly reconnaissance, and this took them deep into the enemy's territory.
Time, 2 p.m. Height, 10,000 feet. Soon after crossing the lines, a hostile formation of seven or more machines was seen over Cambrai. They attacked our formation, and one of them attempted to turn on to Lieutenant Dean. This threw the enemy machine broadside on to Lieutenant Griffith, who fired a double drum into him at close range, whereupon the German Albatross turned over on its back and went down completely out of control. When our formation reached the lines, 12 enemy aircraft were engaged. Captain Lacey's machine was very badly damaged, the tail being almost shot off. Nevertheless, he managed to make base all right.
In those days, command changed frequently.
Major Tedder has now taken command of the squadron. We have mixed feelings about this, as we had hoped that one of the flight commanders would get the post. He is quiet and not at all impressive.
His quiet efficiency, however, soon made its mark, and the squadron ran more smoothly than ever before. Later, of course, Major Tedder was to become Marshal of the Royal Air Force. The war dragged on, and the battles of Arras, Messines and Ypres took heavy toll of the squadron's aircraft and pilots.
Our losses are high, but our morale is higher. The deep probes into enemy territory mean that we are constantly outnumbered. Nevertheless, 304 of the Hun have fallen to us.
The war ended, and immediately the size of the Air Force was reduced.
The squadron produced 19 aces during the war. That's pilots with five or more aerial victories. This strength of 70 Squadron put them in good stead, disbanding for just 9 days in the interwar years, as the Royal Air Force became an entity in itself and saw the role of the squadron change.
By 1920, only 20 squadrons remained. One of these was 70, which had by this time moved to Heliopolis in Egypt, where they were equipped with Vickers Vimy's. They were operating in the bomber transport role now.
What a days there were. Our first major task was to assist in pioneering the Cairo-Baghdad air route. Navigation aids were few and not too reliable, and so a system of markers had to be evolved which could be visually sighted from the air to let the pilot see he was still on course. It seems laughable now, but in fact the system we finally adopted was to plough a furrow right the way across the desert from one end of our part of the route to the other. We also prepared landing strips at 20-mile intervals along the route, and believe me, we had our troubles there. I remember one of the chaps writing to me,
"Dear Major Smith, I am very sorry indeed, but I have made a mess of things. I came into land, landed quite normally, ran over one of the many hills on the aerodrome, and hit a camel. As a result, I now need two new propellers, a nose piece, and an undercarriage for the port side."
Yes, what days they were. We flew the Baghdad route from 1921 to 1927, and then handed it over to Imperial Airways.
In 1922, the squadron moved to Iraq and continued in their dual bomber transport role. Border skirmishes, a feature of that time, were quickly quelled by a few well-placed bombs on the warring tribesmen. The squadron also took on a VIP role, and on one occasion, three kings were flown together in the same aircraft. This, surely a record.
The VIP role of the squadron now lies with 32 Squadron, who were also based in Cyprus 50 years ago. 70 returned to Iraq in 1941 and again between 2003 and 2011 at the heart of operations. Tim joined the squadron in 2008 as the last ever co-pilot of the Hercules before converting onto 70's latest aircraft, the A400M.
There was quite a bit of flying going around at the time when I joined, but I was a single guy living in the mess, so I was always volunteering to go and do as much flying as possible. So in my short 3 years there, I did five Falklands deployments, one Iraq Telic deployment and one Herrick Afghanistan deployment, which is a reasonable amount in that period of time. Throughout history, I know it's been involved in many conflicts and many war zones over its, you know, very long history now, and I think it will continue to be so. The nature of the aircraft that we fly these days means that currently we are, you know, supporting operations, and in the future we will be supporting them in a more tactical role, actually going into the theatres of operation.
Indeed, its role during World War II saw the squadron involved with many frontline operations, which saw 70 Squadron receive their largest number of battle honours to date, but under a different guise.
Another important job in the 20s and 30s was search and rescue. Increasing civil and military flights over the desert route meant that we were often called upon to look for aircraft which were overdue. In one three-day period in 1936, no less than six such calls were received, one of which was to rescue a passenger and crew of the Imperial Airways aircraft, which had force-landed 150 miles from Bahrain.
In 1936, King Edward VIII approved the squadron badge and motto. A demi-winged lion erased with the motto, Usquam.
Usquam, literally translated, means anywhere, certainly descriptive of the squadron role. The use of the lion as a squadron emblem began in 1923. The squadron was then equipped with Vickers Vernons, which were powered by the Lion engine.
The rumblings of war finally erupted in September of 1939, and the squadron left Iraq and moved back to Heliopolis in Egypt, where they were equipped with Wellingtons. They arrived back on the day Italy entered the war, and just 20 years from the time they had first been based there. Life in Egypt was gayer at first, with its clubs and hotels. The role of the squadron now quickly changed to that of a totally bomber one. Life was not without its amusing incidents.
Shortly after the Americans came into the war, they sent some Liberators and B-25s to the Middle East. Before they could start ops at night, their crews came along with our squadron for night flying experience. After this, they carried out a long cross-country night flight on their own. On several occasions, aircraft got lost, and I vividly remember one crew which crashed out in Sinai. We went to look for them and found them about midday. As we got near the kite, one of the Yanks shouted, "We're over here, who are you?" I shouted back, "We're South African search team." Back came the reply, "Gee, I knew we were a long way off route, but not that goddamn far."
The war adopted something of a routine air about it. We bombed the enemy daily up and down the Western Desert. These operations soon got dubbed with the name of the Mail Run, and one of the squadron lads, Flying Officer Dippy Drussel, was inspired to write the Mail Run melody, which eventually became one of the best-known songs of the Desert War.
Take off from the Western Desert, to Sicily or on line. Same old Wimpy, same old aircrew, same old car, same old time. 70 squadron, 70 squadron, though we say it with a sigh, to the bloody head.
They had a very good work hard, play hard relationship on 70 Squadron previous. If you weren't working, you weren't in work. And I, on occasion, did go into work because I'd been sat in the mess for a few weeks doing nothing, waiting for my next flight, and got told swiftly by the boss, "Why are you here? Go home. Do something else. We don't want to see you unless you've got something to do." So it was a very good atmosphere to work in. A lot of fond memories from back then. It was a very different beast to what we have now. I wouldn't say it was more dangerous. It was certainly there were more elements where we could do more things because it was, as we say, much more established.
The squadron motto "Anywhere" rang true throughout the war, as it does to this day, flying across the forces world and evolving through different types of aircraft.
The Desert War meant that we were often on the move. On one occasion, we suffered a temporary setback and retreated 400 miles to Aberswear. We adopted a young Arab boy, and the poor little beggar had to be left behind when we moved. Damn it if he didn't turn up 3 weeks later, having walked all the way to join us.
The war moved on through Sicily and Italy, and 70 found themselves bombing marshalling yards and troop concentrations using their well-proven Wellington bombers. The end of the war came quickly, but not before, in the final stages, they were re-equipped with Liberators. These they used to good effect when, at the war's end, they moved to Palestine and back to the bomber transport role once more.
In 1948, we received our first Dakotas and became, for the first time, an entirely transport force. In 1950, we converted to Valettas and continued in that role, trooping and flying supplies to just about every known airstrip in the Middle East.
In 1955, the squadron received its standard, the award of which was approved in 1943.
"We are gathered here to consecrate this standard, solemn symbol of our loyalty, and with it ourselves, our service, our life. May this standard never be unfurled, save in the cause of justice, righteousness, and truth."
60 years after receiving their standard, 70 Squadron were presented with a new standard by Princess Anne in a different direction for the Royal Air Force. BFBS Bryce Norton's Alex Gill spoke to Wing Commander Simon Boyle, OC of the squadron in 2014, when it was officially reformed after disbanding in 2010.
"Well, 70 Squadron is going to be the first dedicated frontline squadron to operate Atlas. So we look forward to 206 Reserve Squadron and their test and evaluation activities, and 24 Squadron delivering the training output to us so that we can take the aircraft and operate it in the frontline capacity. We're approaching our 100th anniversary, like a number of other RAF squadrons, particularly at RAF Bryce Norton. First a fighter squadron in the First World War, then a bomber squadron, and then after the Second World War into an air transport role. Finally, it returned to RAF Lynham in the early 1970s to operate the C-130K, and it remained there operating the C-130K until 2010, when the squadron was stood down to await its standing back up as the first A400M squadron.
So what does that mean to you to be the first squadron to take on the A400M operationally?
It's a huge honour and a privilege, clearly, to be part of the team charged with responsibility bringing the aircraft into service with the Royal Air Force. A huge amount of work to do, but an incredible team here. And I was very fortunate in that I'm arriving to the programme rather late, and there's an awful lot that had been done that was there ready for me to take on. In terms of starting a squadron, the squadron was put to bed incredibly well in 2010, which meant that the job of returning the squadron's history to the walls around the building to make it feel lived in again has been relatively straightforward and an absolute joy to be able to do. But of course, it's not just about the squadron's history, it's about driving the programme forward as well, and we're very conscious about where we need to get the aircraft and how we unlock its undoubted potential. And so the team is building around me now so that we can focus on that and work with 206 Squadron and 24 Squadron to achieve that. And now we wait excitedly and expectantly for the throughput of aircrew to start to follow, so the pilots and the WizOp crewmen to come to the squadron behind them.
Providing tactical airlift and strategic oversized lift capabilities, complementing the likes of the Hercules and C-17, the Atlas has been deployed to the likes of the South Atlantic, Belize, Spain and Norway, as well as supporting Operation Shader in the Middle East and delivering freight for personnel on Exercise Red Flag, a training opportunity for the US Air Force and its allies, including the Royal Air Force.
People of the British Virgin Islands, this is Governor Gough Jaspert. I come to you with a heavy heart after experiencing and observing the extent of devastation caused by Hurricane Irma. After consultation with the Premier, I have declared a state of emergency for the territory. My thoughts and prayers are with each and every one of you.
2017. 70 Squadron provided vital support to the UK relief effort in the Caribbean after Hurricane Irma. The Category 5 tropical cyclone saw wind speeds of 185 miles per hour, killed over 130 people, and left thousands without shelter and power, facing hunger and disease. The UK's humanitarian assistance operation, Op Reuman, lasted for 5 weeks and saw 70 Squadron as the integral part of the humanitarian and disaster relief efforts. As the A400M arrived home at RAF Bryce Norton, Wing Commander Ed Horn spoke about the success of the operation.
The A400M, two aircraft deployed from RAF Bryce Norton on the 8th of September. The first aircraft has arrived back just now, just over a month later. And in that time, the aircraft and the crews and my engineers have been moving all manner of aid, military personnel, equipment, building materials, water, food, anything that you can think of between Barbados and different islands in the Caribbean.
So that's really the main role and where they've come into their own, is that the aircraft, they weren't so much about taking the stuff out, they were, once it was there, getting it to all the various points where it needed to go and getting into some of the harder to reach areas.
Yes, 70 Squadron and the A400M have been based in Barbados, which has been the hub of all the British military activity. And from Barbados, they've been going to the outlying islands, including the Turks and Caicos Islands, the British Virgin Islands, Anguilla, and many of the other locations as well, and taking the freight, equipment, personnel from Barbados into those locations. And then in times of need and frankly desperation of some of the local nationals that are out there, extracting some of the people back to places of safety that have really lost absolutely everything as the hurricane swept through their homes and houses.
So is this really where the A400M shows off what it can do with its capabilities and its ability to get into those areas?
Operation Reuman has been the first real operation that we've been at the centre at with the A400M. What we really always knew, that the aircraft would come into its own in this kind of scenario, where we needed to move equipment, people, building materials, food and water into some really short runways. Some of these islands are quite small, so there isn't a great deal of space to build runways, and many of the runways are very short, and that's where the aircraft really comes into its own.
And so what does it mean to you as OC of 70 Squadron at this time when it's been involved in one of its biggest operations so far?
Well, it's a really proud moment for me as the squadron commander to recover everybody safely back to Bryce Norton after a month of operational activity overseas. And it's a relief to have everybody back, but it's a really proud moment as well. It's been a real team effort for the squadron, for the air crew, for the administrative staff, for the engineers that have been keeping the aircraft serviceable and flying round the clock. A real team effort, so it's a real proud moment to have everybody back and the job done.
The FBS RAF 100 wings over Cyprus. 70 Squadron.
The week that the Royal Air Force turned 100 in April 2018, British Forces South Atlantic Islands saw the A400M replace the Hercules, an aircraft that has been synonymous with 70 Squadron for 35 years. Flight Lieutenant Jamie Jackson was the first pilot of the A400M RAF fleet to reach 1,000 flying hours.
There's a few main reasons why we're here. We are maritime reconnaissance, again in support of the Falklands Island government for fisheries licensing. It's also maritime reconnaissance for any other ships or vessels that may come into the JOA. We also provide a search and rescue capability, which would be for any incident that happens within the waters around here, and that could be fishing vessels, downed aircraft, anything that requires a search and rescue capability. And we also provide a capability for compassionate cases to fly them to the mainland, and an aeromed capability if there was anybody either on the base or at the hospital in Stanley that required to be evacuated to the mainland. The airspace is a lot less cluttered and congested back in the UK, so when we get to fly, we really get to operate the aircraft to the edge of the limits that perhaps we wouldn't be able to in the UK. We get to do a lot of things when we're doing our maritime reconnaissance, flying over the ships and things we generally don't do back home. So it's just been a fantastic experience using the aircraft to its developing capability. It's amazing. It's one of the most modern aircraft in the Royal Air Force fleet at the moment. It's a generation ahead of the C-17, which I flew beforehand, and it's just a delight to fly. It's Airbus's first go at building military aircraft, so they've thrown a lot of time, energy and effort at trying to make it the premier tactical and strategic airlifter in the Royal Air Force.
A multitude of roles and responsibilities in the Falkland Islands, the crew also frequent further south on Exercise Cold Stare.
Cold Stare is about an 8-hour flight down to the South Georgia and the South Sandwich Islands. There's two main things. One is maritime reconnaissance, so we're assisting the Falkland Island government, ensuring that all fishing vessels down there are correctly licensed. And secondly, it's looking at the geological condition of the islands. So the South Sandwich Islands are all produced by volcanic activity, so it's checking that none of them have become active since the last cold stare. And some of them, they're obviously volcanic shaped, and you can see massive clouds of steam coming out of them. Even though they're not active, they're still known as kind of steaming volcanoes. So it's an amazing view out the window when you see the clouds of smoke coming out of the top of them. It's the first time we've gone down there, so very lucky, and what an amazing privilege and view we had out of the window.
Looking back to the 50th anniversary of the Royal Air Force, 70 Squadron were based in Cyprus. They relocated in 1955 from Egypt, where they received their standard.
Shortly after this, the squadron moved to Nicosia, once more changing aircraft, this time to the Hastings, that workhorse of the Royal Air Force for so many years. In addition to their transport tasks, search and rescue now loomed large in their commitments.
In April, an air charter Tudor was reported missing whilst en route to Woomera. It was carrying a highly secret load, and the squadron turned all its effort to search for it. We found it, after many hours searching, high up in the Turkish mountains.
Search and rescue is still, of course, a primary role of the squadron. In the recent comet disaster between Rhodes and Cyprus, and when the Israeli submarine Dakar was lost, 70 were airborne giving their assistance. In 1966, the squadron celebrated its 50th anniversary. Lord Tedder, the squadron commander so many years before, was present to enjoy this half-century mark in the squadron's history. Shortly after this, the squadron moved to Akrotiri.
70 Squadron have served continuously in the Middle East for the last 48 years. We have in fact become known as the Middle East Squadron. Aircraft have changed much in that time. The old and trusty Hastings has now given way to the Argosy, but our role remains virtually unchanged.
After a short time operating the Armstrong Whitworth Argosy, 70 Squadron began the conversion to the Hercules in 1970 and then moved to RAF Lynham in 1975, after 55 years overseas. But as their motto anywhere states, they are on national standby in the UK and general task in support of the permanent joint headquarters, which could see them deployed anywhere in the world. That includes Cyprus. Although they're not based there permanently, unlike their forefathers in Akrotiri 50 years ago, the A400M and its crew see 70 Squadron supporting Operation Shader. Being established longer than the Royal Air Force itself, 70 Squadron have embraced 20th century technologies. They were the first British fighter squadron equipped with a machine gun synchronised to fire through propellers, but have also embraced 21st century innovations, not just on the airfield, but online too. Wing Commander Ed Horn.
We set the squadron up in 2014 when the aircraft first came into service. A new generation of aircraft, if you will, a new generation of aircrew, engineers and people surrounding the aircraft, getting the aircraft into the sky. And we decided that it would be a really good idea to embrace social media right from the outset and set up our Twitter feed and contribute to other social media outlets like Facebook and through all our other social media colleagues and partners like RAF Bryce Norton, like BFBS as well, to create a buzz around the aircraft. And for me, certainly, as the commanding officer of the squadron, a buzz around 70 Squadron and what we do. And I think because it's such a new aircraft, it looks exciting when you can see it. It makes a great noise when it flies past as well. It's just grown arms and legs over and above anything that we would have expected, especially as we're still in growth. We're still receiving aircraft deliveries, we're still growing the capability of the aircraft. And because of that, and because it's their job and in some cases their way of life, they want to show it off. They really want to show people what we can do and how exciting the life that they lead is through the aircraft, but also how capable the aircraft is. We've just started our sort of annual pilgrimage, if you will, up to Norway, supporting the defence exercise programme with various different other military, army, Royal Marine units that exercise in Norway at this time of year, and that's what you've been seeing recently.
Marking the centenary of the RAF over Buckingham Palace in the A400M, 70 Squadron have proved themselves as the go-to squadron for air transport worldwide, proving their flexibility and loyalty to its motto, anywhere.
The spirit of 70 has always been high, but never higher than today.
Wings Over Cyprus was written and narrated by Arthur Stagg and produced by Kathy Emmett in the Episcopi Studios.
Wings Over Cyprus, the 2018 version, was presented and produced by Jess Bracey.